From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a story from the singer Dionne Warwick's early career that tells you something about her character. You probably know about her remarkably successful collaboration with Burt Bacharach and Hal David. Well, before any of that success, the two had promised her the song Make It Easy on Yourself. And when Warwick heard that song on the radio being sung by someone else, she was furious. And here she was, young and inexperienced. She had no leverage, except, of course, her talent. And she let Burt Bacharach have it. And one of the things she said was, "Don't make me over. You know, don't lie to me." Well, Bacharach used the scolding to write the song Don't Make Me Over. It was their first hit. Today in the program, we're talking about Dionne Warwick, discussing a documentary film in the works about her life, her music, and her activism. Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You have to be ready to tell your story. And the filmmaker Ellen Gusenberg Kent says Dionne Warwick is ready. It's not like she hasn't told parts of the story. She wrote an autobiography a few years ago. She's been interviewed and profiled dozens and dozens of times. But Gusenberg Kent says there are parts of the story she hasn't told before, at least wants to emphasize now. People know about the music career and the remarkable success and popularity, but there's also, of course, her activism. There's her music education, her humanitarian voice that came later. Ellen Gusenberg Kent is in the process of making a film about Warwick's life. And so as part of our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center, we're going to be talking about it today. Next week, we'll be screening some clips from the film. Dionne Warwick will be there, be here in Salt Lake City to join us on stage at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. We'll give you details about that as we go. We're going to begin with Dionne Warwick herself joining us from her home in Los Angeles. She, of course, is a multiple Grammy award-winning singer. She's charted more hits than any woman not named Aretha Franklin. She served as a United Nations Global Ambassador for the Food and Agriculture Organization and a United States Ambassador of Health. And Dionne Warwick, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to begin, I guess, with this. You've written the book.
Mm-hmm.
You have been interviewed. I'm sure you probably can't even count how many times.
Well, it's been quite a bit.
What is it that interested you about being profiled in a documentary? Were you reluctant at all at first, or did you think it's time?
Well, I think it is time. It's, you know, people have preconceived conceptions of who I am and what I do and what I don't do, et cetera, et cetera. And it's now, I think, time for them to hear it directly from me what I do and what I don't do.
What would you say is one of the misperceptions, if you can come up with one? Too many?
There have been too many, yeah. I mean, but I think it goes with the territory.
Yeah.
I'm not the only one that has that happened to them, as you can well imagine.
Right. You know what interested me reading your autobiography is the music education part. I mean, I get the singing part. I get the magnificent success in your career part. But the fact that you went back after you had been incredibly successful to get a master's degree in music, you got a bachelor's degree, you had a scholarship to study music. Mm-hmm. Would you talk a little bit about that, the importance of education, music education for you?
Well, it primarily is probably the most important thing that anyone can secure. You have to know in order to do. I feel it's just been. It got to the point on the road, especially. That, I mean, how much television can you do, and how much needlepoint can you do?
Right.
And I was very, very fortunate in that I had access to my professor, Joe Mulready, from Hart, to come on the road with me to take me through all my degrees.
It's interesting. You've talked about how you would go to see Sammy Davis Jr. or Ella Fitzgerald or Lena Horne or mm-hmm. Frank Sinatra, and you said that was, for you, in some ways, going to class.
Absolutely. You know, all of these icons who became my mentors during the course of my career were doing things that I wanted to do know, working in the places I really wanted to end up working, singing songs that they were even singing that I felt that I was capable of doing. So it was a class for me.
I love also hearing you've written a bit about working with Burt Bacharach and the kind of education in some ways you received from him. You mentioned that the time signature changes he would throw at you, the shifting intervals of notes he would throw at you, almost as if he was wondering if there's let's see what she can handle.
Exactly, let's see what else she can do.
Yeah,
yeah. I have said it, and I'll continue to say, you almost have to have a music education to pull off his music. His music is he marches to his own drummer, and
yeah.
You have to kind of join in the line.
You know, one of the stories that I certainly hadn't heard is that when you went to France first in 1962,
mm-hmm.
You were kind of influenced by Marlene Dietrich. She kind of took you under her wing, if I get that right.
That's right. She was one of my mentors, and Bert was her musical conductor.
Right.
And he found out that I was going to perform at the Olympia in Paris, and he knew that it'd be my very first trip abroad all by myself. And he said, no, the little girl needs to be protected. And he made a phone call to Marlena and asked her to look after me, and that's what she did.
There's that story that I mentioned earlier in the introduction. I'm not sure if you got a chance to hear it, but there's that famous story that you have told about Don't Make Me Over. You know, your dispute with Hal and Bert, and you're pretty young at the time.
Yeah.
And you say, you know, they promised you a song. You heard it on the radio. It was Jerry Butler singing it. You're pretty upset. And you said, you confronted them, don't make me over.
Exactly.
But here's the thing that's interesting about that is you didn't have much at the time. I mean, who are you to be confronting Burt Bacharach and Hal David at the time? But it seems to show a kind of chutzpah on your part. Does that reveal something about your character?
Well, I think more than anything else, we were all kind of starting at the same time.
Hmm.
You know, they had not reached anywhere near the pinnacle that they finally did reach.
Yeah.
You know, when I promised them something, I delivered. And I was taught that promises are not to be broken, they're to be adhered to. And I was pretty upset about that whole thing. You know, they had said, because they had badgered me, come on, you have to record. And I finally said, okay, only if. You make it easy on yourself as one of my very first recordings.
Yeah.
And as it turned out, they didn't live up to their promise, and it wasn't a very nice thing to do, I felt.
Right.
I had to let them know.
So you stood your ground. I mean, and I wonder if that's been one of the characteristics of your career. I mean, it seems like making your own choices, being independent. Has that been a hallmark of your career?
That's the way I was brought up.
Yeah.
You know, we each have a voice, and we have an opinion. You know, not to be, as my mommy said, a good girl. You know, and confront people, but also always stand your ground, especially if you feel you're right.
Yeah.
And if I were not right in that instance, I felt then I would have had no recourse. But I felt I was absolutely right, and I still, whenever I feel whatever the case might be, if I feel that I'm right, you're going to hear it.
Mm. I guess in some ways it all comes back to, or seems to me anyway, to gospel music, because you said gospel has always been and will always be first and foremost,
mm-hmm.
in terms of your music.
Absolutely. That's where I was raised, in church. My grandfather was a minister. That's basically all I knew, and you know, I believe in God very, very, very deeply. And singing gospel music basically is singing the Bible in song. So it will always be prevalent in my life. And the reason I feel that I am doing what I'm doing, I feel it's a wonderful gift that God gave me. And apparently I must be using it the way he wants me to use it, because he's letting it alone.
You say in your book that when you were making, this was early in your career, and you were making that transition from being a gospel singer to making recordings of popular music. You said that there at the at your church there, I guess in Newark, at the St. Luke's AME Church, that there were kind of whispers.
Oh, yeah, there were, you know, and it was a case of, oh, why is she doing that, you know, and in essence, I feel you find your biggest hypocrites right there in church. However, my grandfather, who, God bless and rest him, I felt was probably one of the wisest men that walked this earth, second only to Jesus, I must admit that. But he confronted the congregation, let them know that my baby has a gift, and it's a gift that we're all enjoying, whether we want to admit it or not. And you have no right to criticize her. Instead, embrace her. Mm. And that's exactly what they all did.
So you're still singing, you're still doing some touring, I guess. At what point do you think it's time?
It's getting close.
Yeah.
I must admit, it is getting close. The road has changed so drastically. Just the traveling alone.
Sure.
It's very, very difficult on the body. And I'm not 12 years old any longer.
Right. There's this, you talked about this conversation you once had with Sammy Davis Jr. He told you that he wanted to die on stage.
Yeah, I never understood that. No, That's not where I want to die. I want to die in my bed. Sound asleep.
Well, this documentary film is being made about your life. Are you feeling uneasy about that? Are you feeling comfortable with that? I mean, how are you feeling about this film? This, you know, you've seen plenty of profiles, but what do you think about this?
And I'm going to enjoy it, I'm sure, because the truth is the complete part of what this is all about. You know, nothing will be said or done that is not appropriate or apparently true about Dionne Warwick, because Dionne Warwick is in control.
Right. Well, it's Dionne Warwick. Joined us from her home in Los Angeles. Next Wednesday evening, the Utah Film Center is hosting an evening with Dionne Warwick. We'll be talking to her. She'll also be performing a selection of her greatest hits.
Not all of them.
Not all of them. Only a couple.
That's right.
You should show up.
But you, please.
Yeah. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Mm-hmm. Ms. Warwick, thank you very much for taking the time.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to seeing you all.
Radio, you're listening to Radio West. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going to continue our documentary series, and we're going to profile one that's still in the works. The filmmaker Ellen Gusenberg Kent is exploring the life of the singer Dionne Warwick. And so she's with us today to talk about what she's learned so far. Warwick came out of the tradition of gospel music, sang with her family. Her grandfather was a minister, and at some point, she broke out, one of the first, in fact, to transition from gospel to popular music. The film is about Warwick's struggle with racism, finding her activist voice, and we're going to be screening some scenes from it. Dionne Warwick will be joining us next week. I'll give you some more details a little bit about that. Ellen Gusenberg Kent is an Academy Award-winning filmmaker, the director of the documentary film that's now in the works, as I mentioned, called Don't Make Me Over, Dionne Warwick's Crossover Journey. She's joining us from the studios of NPR in New York City. And Ellen Gusenberg Kent, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also joining us today is Dave Woolley, a longtime collaborator and friend of Dionne Warwick, co-authored her autobiography called My Life as I See It. He's also a co-producer of the documentary film, and he's joining us from a studio on the campus of the University of Delaware in Newark, Delaware. And Dave Woolley, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Ellen, I want to begin with you, if we could, and let's just talk about how all of this started, how you came to the project.
Well, I like to think it was an incredible stroke of luck. There were some mutual friends who had met Dave and had been talking to Dave about Dionne's interest in telling her story on the occasion of the 55th anniversary of her career in the music business. And for me, Dionne was sort of woven into the musical landscape of my youth. My mother was a big fan of hers and used to play her music at home along with Harry Belafonte and a lot of Brazilian bossa nova, which I later learned is a big love of Dionne's. And so I felt emotional connection to her music. I remembered that's what friends are for. I remembered her sort of standing up for AIDS. And then I thought, you know, I have so many questions about this woman. She really charted a new path in the music business. So she was an icon, but also a mystery.
Yeah.
And that was a very seductive combination for me. I wanted to know, what was it like to be a first, to be a trailblazer, to sort of cross over and chart a different path than a lot of the other artists that I was interested in at the time. And I was also really curious about what she might be able to impart about the road to recognition for people of color in Hollywood and in music and in our culture today, where we're sort of in this troubling place, despite the gorgeous examples of icons like Dionne.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think for some people, when they hear Dionne Warwick, they're going to think, okay, she was, you know, popular singer, had an amazing amount of hits, and that's probably as far as their thinking goes about that. I mean, her activism didn't really come front and center until later, I suppose, in her sort of career arc, and we'll get to that here in a moment. But what were the questions you had for her? Because, I think a lot of us think of her, oh, she was this really popular singer, but what else is going on in her life?
Yeah. Well, you know, you start your research and then, you know, the questions come. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I began to sort of look into her early career, I started to realize something. You know, when she began as a young artist, she performed on two different music circuits.
Yeah.
And this is sort of fascinating to me because she was a kid, really. I mean, when she first started out with Bacharach and David, she wore pigtails. You know, she was maybe 17. So she's on two different music tours when she first begins. One is the Sam Cooke tour. It's part of the Chitlin circuit. You know, she began to, you know, sort of see what the segregated South looked like. She certainly was aware of the discrimination there. And then she was also invited to perform on sort of higher end tours that were organized by Dick Clark. And so she had to experience this racial divide right away.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think what sort of fascinates me and one of the things that's sort of driving me in this film is she seems to have recognized right away the possibility of being a bridge. What she could not have had any idea about is what that would require. You know, the kind of strength that would demand, the weight she'd have to bear, you know, what she'd be representing. And we have to remember this was, you know, the early 60s.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a way different world than the one we're in today in terms of culture, music, and entertainment.
How will it, Dave, I want to get you on this here in a moment, but let me just, I'm interested, Ellen, when her willingness to talk about this. I mean, she grows up sort of middle class in some ways in the North, in New Jersey. Doesn't really experience, at least she talks about in the book that she wrote with Dave, discrimination until she goes on the tour and goes on tour in the South. And there's some kind of frightening, remarkable stories from that, and we can get to that in a moment. But how willing was she, Ellen, to talk about race? Those questions of race?
I think it was the first thing she said to me. Mm. She said to me, how comfortable are you
right
talking about race?
Huh.
And I said, I'm as comfortable as you are, you know, and where are we going to go with this? And, you know, she was completely open to this conversation. I think that, you know, you grow up and you find your voice, and she found her creative voice right away. And maybe she found the rest of her voice over the years. And I think, you know, there are a lot of reasons why Dionne may not have wanted to or felt comfortable having this conversation decades ago. We can talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll come to that. Dave Woolley, when she first encountered real racism, I'm guessing she had her taste of it in the North, obviously, but when she went down south for the first time, what did she make of the racism she encountered there?
Well, Dionne grew up in a community that was, she called it United Nations. Her block, Sterling Street, was like United Nations, where she had every race, every creed on, you know, a four-block radius. I think that was the preparation as a little girl, 6 years old, 7 years old, preparing her for her global success and being able to deal with all races around the world and cultures around the world. In fact, we, Dionne and I, co-authored a children's book called Say a Little Prayer, kind of based on that premise. She thought going to the South and during the early 60s, that this whole prejudice, this whole Jim Crow, this whole era that we were living in America was really silly. It's really stupid. And we talk about it in the book where she gets off the tour bus and she wants to get a drink of water. And it says for whites only. And there's one right next to it says for coloreds only. And a white lady bends down and drinks, and Dionne bends down and drinks. They bump heads. And then Dionne says, you know, we're really drinking the same water. And the lady says, what do you mean? And it was basically one pipe coming to both fountains. And the lady turned red, you know. I think that's what's fascinating about where we are today.
What does that story tell you, though, Dave? I mean, that she had the kind of audacity to speak the absurdity of that moment, I guess.
Yeah, and she still does.
Right?
Yeah, Dionne, you know, it starts off with that don't make me over mentality. And it's one of the thousand things I love about this woman, Dionne Warwick, is she's not afraid to speak the truth. When I think of Dionne, I think of a turtle, somebody with a hard shell, somebody soft on the inside, but not afraid to stick their head out.
Hmm. Ellen, was did you have to gain her trust to get the get the words flowing, the stories going? I mean, she's been interviewed so many times.
Well, you know, we're starting this process. I mean, I certainly think that trust is important. And, you know, I certainly have spent, you know, a lot of time talking with Dave as well, so that we can kind of align a vision for the film. And I think, you know, that there are certain things that Dionne has talked about. She's, you know, there are certainly relationships that she's had, people that have mentored her, people that she's mentored. In the way that she's sort of spoken about them, you know, sort of begins to open a door to some of, you know, where she'd like to go with the film. And so, you know, I would say I'm her best student right now.
Did she? She didn't. I mentioned the importance of things like musical education, and one of the things I didn't get a chance to talk to her about. Maybe we can do it next week. She mentions, and maybe, Dave, you can say something about this, that music wasn't the only thing she was interested in when she was young. She says she wanted to be a ballerina at some point.
You know, it's never too late. Dionne has such a spirit about her and a sense of discovery. And I think that must have started very, very early on in her life. She wanted to be a ballerina. The one that cracks me up is she wanted as a little girl to be the elevator operator. She thought that was the coolest thing, to wear white gloves and tell people to step in lively. You know, that little handle that you used to pull, yeah, and pull a gate. But fortunately for the world, she became an iconic singer.
Ellen, one of the things you've talked about is that she was raised in this era when you weren't supposed to speak out. And that you've said that you think in some ways maybe her public voice had been muted for a time. I mean, I don't think, I mean, beyond her aid activism, maybe people don't think of her as a kind of social activist, even though she has been. Would you say something about that?
I mean, I think, you know, maybe Dionne leads with her actions more than her words, although certainly she has spoken out, you know, and in areas where it wasn't comfortable to do so, wasn't safe to do so. Certainly, you know, in her championing of awareness around AIDS, she spoke out very loud and clear, and certainly around the misogyny and rap lyrics. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, it's interesting because her experience is echoed even today. I mean, I was just reading an interview with Shonda Rhimes, who is sort of the powerhouse creator of so many successful TV series. And, you know, she talks about the burden for African-American women performers and what it takes to be successful, the fragility of being a pioneer, right? And she says that, you know, as a black artist, you're always to some degree a cultural outsider, and you have to be kind of the most perfect, least threatening version, because any mistake that you make will be amplified. And, you know, you can't be merely good. You have to be inspirational. And I think, you know, Dionne was inspirational. And I think she felt that by living her life and handling her career in an impeccable way, that that was her speaking out. Came later when artists did begin to feel a responsibility to sort of speak out in very specific ways about, you know, racial issues, about issues of being female in the music business and all of those things. But I don't think a lot of artists did that in the early 60s, you know? I mean, it's something that's evolved over time, and now it almost feels like a requirement.
Yeah.
In order to be relevant, you have to be vocal in very specific ways about what's going on in the world. I think that's something that's evolved.
Her speaking out about misogyny in rap, for example, was a risk, and she took a hit for a while. I mean, it was further complicated by the fact that her own son, Damon, was getting into the business. He's kind of a big deal in the business now. I mean, what was the fallout from that sort of thing, and what did that say about her willingness to speak out at the time?
Dave can speak to this. I'll just say one thing about it, and that is that certainly it got complicated. You know, there were very strong feelings on various sides of the issue. But I think in the end, you have to look at sort of what came out of that effort of hers. And that is that she recorded a song with a number of rap artists, which utilized her song "What the World Needs Now is Love," right? It was sort of a rap version of that song. And a number of artists who had felt very alienated from her stand in the beginning, in the end came to sort of embrace her as, you know, an auntie, you know, as a mother, as somebody who, you know, had something to say. You know, they began to understand the damage done when black women are disparaged and disrespected. And she was willing to talk about that. So in the end, I think it turned out pretty well. But Dave, what do you think?
Well, you know, I think it, once again, it speaks to that "don't make me over." You know, Dionne's courage and willingness to stand up for what she believes is the truth and what is right. And that was wrong. And as a consequence, you know, hip hop and rap music is forever changed. You did not have a Walmart version. You did not have a parental advisory on CDs of hip hop artists. All of that exists now. Dionne personally invited Suge Knight and Tupac Shakur to her house for a meeting for breakfast at 7 o'clock in the morning.
No way.
And believe it or not. Yes, yes. At seven, even her family, her son, thought she was crazy. She was shocked that Not that they showed up, but that they showed up, Tupac and Suge Knight and the crew showed up on time at 7 o'clock in the morning, which meant that they probably stayed up all night.
Yeah.
But, you know, she had a very, very productive meeting with them. And once again, was not afraid to go to the White House, not afraid to go to Congress and make some things check, you know, where other artists would have left that alone. Mm-hmm. Today, they call her Auntie D. Ice Cube was with her recently with the big hug for his new movie, Barbershop. All of the hip hop artists from Diddy to Jay-Z, all of them pay homage to her because she made the industry better.
Let's back up a bit and talk a little bit about her early life. She, in your book that you wrote together, you can tell the kind of abiding respect she has for both of her grandparents, but certainly her grandfather, who was a minister, her biggest fan, as she talks about. What was the early life like? What were the expectations for Marie Dionne Warwick? And can we just explain that Warwick is her stage name? And was it, Dave, do you want to tell the story just how we got Warwick as opposed to Warwick?
Yeah, one is spelled with double R's and the other one is W-A-R-W-I-C-K. The family name is with the one with the double R's. The record label, Scepter, actually misprinted her first single, and it was too late. It had already reached record stores and this record had already started creating some momentum. So she went along with it, and that's how she became Dionne Warwick as we know her today. But the expectations early on in her family was education. Education was and you have a situation where her father was a Pullman, which was one of the best jobs in the 50s. And for an African-American man to have on a train. That was a very, very top professional job. Dionne did not grow up in the projects. She did not grow up in poverty. So this is a different type of a story. This is a middle class, upper middle class African-American family that we don't see. Dionne had a fireplace in her home. So this is not a rags to riches type of a story. This is a story where education was first and foremost. Her grandfather, as she said, you know, just think of what's the pastor of the church, who she still credits with being the wisest man on this planet, second to Jesus.
she says that all the time, by the way.
I think it's great. you know, so education and was very important, and it still is very important. So we took the liberty in writing this book and making it an educational tool. If you notice, after most of the chapters, there are lessons learned. So it has an academic, it has a cognitive value to the book, and it's an exciting read, I think.
I wanted you to this may not be easy, but describe her the gift in her voice. What is it about Dionne's voice, and where do you figure that comes from? Are you, Dave, able to hear the kind of gospel elements, even in the popular music that she creates later? I mean, what is that? Because there's something incredibly distinctive about her voice. How do you guys describe it?
Well, first, let me just say, Dionne's a genius. And I have been closely associated with her for over 20 years. And you know, you first have to, if you start off with that premise, then everything else will be okay.
Okay, good.
You just don't have that much luck consistently for as long as she has, just intuitively.
You know?
She has relative pitch. You hit a note, a C on a piano, she can sing an F. You hit an A, she can sing a B. You know, it's a gift that only could have been given to her from God, and she treasures it, and she has nurtured it for over 55 years. And that's the simplest way to explain it. You know, there's certain things. How do you explain Picasso? How do you explain, you know, Martin Luther King? How do you explain? There's certain things that you just can't explain. You just enjoy while they're here.
Yeah, it's a good point. But I guess the thing that I wondered about was, so you've got this raw material that was brilliant. And what was it about gospel? And what was it maybe even about the songs she was singing early in those days with Burt Bacharach and the sort of emotional weight of those lyrics by Hal David that helped shape that voice, I guess is what I'm getting at. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Let me jump in for a second. So, you know, these are iconic songs today, but when Dion was singing those songs, they were strange.
Yeah.
They weren't popular. They weren't embraced by the African-American community at all.
Right.
You know, like, what's that about? Who's that?
Right. You know? That's such a good
point. Yeah. You know, promises, you know. So today, we embrace them. But, you know, those songs were not radio friendly. As we know today. However, what the three of them did, Bacharach, David, and Warwick, she calls them the triangle marriage that worked, is they created their own niche. Mm-hmm. They created their own style. They created their own brand of music. And thank God that they did, because all of that music that was popular during that day, you know, where is it today? And here we are, you know, 55 years later, talking about, you know, a song that was recorded, Don't Make Me Over, in the early 60s. And here we are in 2016. And that's because they were unique. Mm. They were very, very unique. They weren't trying for a number one hit. See, there's a difference between being number one and being original, being the first. They were just trying to be the first. When you're number one, as you know, as a recording artist, that song will eventually go down to number two, number three, number four, number five, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you're the first, that's historical. And that's what this is all about, this documentary. It's going to be historical because she is the first. She's an original. She's an American legend, and she's an American master.
What was her, Ellen, what was her relationship with the black community? Because you've sort of, I think you've talked about the fact that she was sort of found herself somewhere in the middle. And maybe it was at a kind of an awkward place to be at times.
You know, I'd like to, I wish she were here to talk more about that. I think, you know, her relationship with the community, let me start by saying,
I mean, it was this idea that black DJs, for example, thought she was too light-skinned or something, and white DJs wouldn't talk to her as if she had any kind of race. So it was just like it was strange.
It's a Netherland, right?
Yeah.
I mean, she is, you know, certainly being played on pop stations.
Right.
Initially, she has talked about, you know, a couple of the more influential African American DJs. Initially thought that she was too white. And I believe she confronted one of them who was, you know, playing Alfie on his radio station in Chicago and, you know, called up and you know, sort of didn't identify herself right away and said, who's this artist, you know? You know, and he said, she's, you know, Dionne Warwick. And then he said, wait a minute, I thought you said I was too white to be played on your station. And so, you know, she sort of called him out on that. You know, listen, I think, you know, that radio was very powerful in those days. And I think, you know, critics are always out to get you. And I think, you know, even today, artists are sometimes, you know, held to a standard that's just, you know, to my mind, ridiculously unfair. You know, you have a voice, you have a talent. She certainly was charting a new path. She was not in the traditional R&B mold. She definitely had a sophistication about her that was unique. You know, and instead of celebrating that in a way, she was criticized for it, as was Whitney Houston later on. You know, there's something about the, you know, the crossover artist has this burden of, you know, sort of constantly having to prove your street cred.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is, you know, that's just not unique to Dion, but I think she was one of the first to really experience that.
Well, there it is in the subtitle of your film, Warwick's Crossover Journey. That's an important theme for you, this idea of crossing over. When did this come up? When was it a sort of an insight that you got in a conversation with her that this was in some ways what the film was about?
I think, you know, she was recognized. as a crossover artist, as was Sam Cooke back in the day. But she was, I think, fairly unique in being an African-American woman artist who sort of crossed over to the pop charts, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And did so sort of instantly, right?
Right.
So there was no sort of history of her, you know, recording maybe R&B or soul music. She created this sort of new, I guess I just keep calling it a unique path, mm-hmm. right? And so, I don't know, you know, people react to that. And I think she just kept going. Yeah. I think, you know, she sort of didn't allow anything to stop her. I mean, you know, she was recording really amazing love songs, but I think that there was sort of more underneath those songs. I think that's why they were resonating for people. You know, she was to some degree choosing songs that were about love and how love could heal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I think that sort of that's what started to really touch people. And, you know, even when she was, you know, sort of up against some perhaps, you know, resistance, let's say, she sort of continued. She continued to be who she was. And, you know, she chose songs that were uplifting and, you know, portrayed strength, you know. And I read an Abby Lincoln quote. It said, "We become what we sing." And Dionne continued to sing about love and, you know, the healing power of that, no matter what, you know, in different kinds of songs, in different contexts. And so she, to some degree, became an embodiment of that.
Yeah, I'd like to jump in and say also that a lot of this has to do with her audience. Hmm. Dionne's audience has been colorblind pretty much from day one. And it still is. You go to a Dionne Warwick show today, and it's like the United Nations. It's beautiful. She and I are on our way to Naples, Italy, Thursday, where she's going to be recognized with a legendary award in Italy. And I have traveled abroad with her, and it just amazes me how people from all over the world can sing our songs, embrace a Dionne, Dionne, Dionne. And they may not be able to speak the language, the American language, but they can sing those songs. And so that love and has not just stayed here in America, it's global. And she's one of the few artists today that can work every continent of this world and sell out venues as she has continuously done.
Is there a difference between the audiences in Europe and the audiences in this country?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, I was recently, Dionne and I went to Cannes together, and we stayed at the Carlton Hotel, which is the very nice five-star hotel, the nicest hotel in Cannes. And she was telling me that in the early 60s, she was asked to perform at the Cannes. And we were talking about hotels, and she said, you know, she could leave America and come to France and stay at a five-star hotel and be treated and eat in the restaurants and go anywhere she wanted, but then get back on a plane and get back to America, and, you know, and the nonsense existed. The Jim Crow was still there. So, you know, there's a lot of stories to be had.
You know, it made me wonder if she spent a lot of time in Brazil, called it home for a long time. Was that one of the elements to that? Is that part of the reason?
I think Brazil was just part of her natural DNA, the culture, the music, the food, the people. It's her second home, and she has a home there where she goes back and forth. I just think it's a magical place, and the people there have embraced her as one of their own.
But the question was, I just wondered, was that a retreat from racism that she encountered in the United States? In Brazil, she didn't have to worry about any of that. I know some musicians have felt that way. Did you get a sense that was part of the appeal for Brazil?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
When you can be treated as you're supposed to be treated, with dignity, with respect, with humanity, with love. You know, you, obviously you want to be in those types of environments. I have been close to that family, the Warwick family, for many, many years. In fact, when I was 16 years old, I was Sissy Houston's drummer growing up in New York City.
Wow.
I grew up in the projects in Harlem. So long before I even met Dion, I was Sissy Houston's drummer, and I knew of Dion because Sissy Houston is Dion's aunt, and of course Sissy is the mother of the great late Whitney Houston.
Yeah.
So I met Whitney as a teenager, and I did many gigs with Sissy and also recorded with her. So, you know, the whole family is one of these families that, that had to deal with this whole racial issue, because early on in Sissy's career, she was Elvis Presley's background singer.
Yeah.
And her group, Sweet Inspiration, you know, recorded and did backgrounds for many of the hits that we hear today on the radio.
Dave Woolley is with us, longtime collaborator and friend of Dionne Warwick, co-authored her autobiography called My Life as I See It. Ellen Gusenberg Kent is also with us. She's a filmmaker and director of the documentary film. Well, she's in the works right now. It's called Don't Make Me Over, Dionne Warwick's Crossover Journey. We should mention that next Wednesday evening, the Utah Film Center is going to be hosting an evening with Dionne Warwick at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Ellen will be there along with Dionne, and they'll join us on stage for a conversation. Dionne will also perform a couple of songs from her greatest hits. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a very quick break and come back for some final thoughts. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
If you see me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet, walk on.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about a documentary film in the works on the life of Dionne Warwick. Next Wednesday night, the Utah Film Center is hosting an evening with Dionne Warwick at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our documentary series, Through the Lens. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Dave Woolley, longtime friend and collaborator, is joining us, along with the film director, Ellen Gusenberg Kent. I wanted to ask Ellen, you, about, so we come sort of to this really important part of her story, of her life, being outspoken about and doing fundraisers for the AIDS crisis in the 80s. How significant was this? Because this was one of those, I mean, and you mentioned Ronald Reagan, the president of the United States, wouldn't even say the word for a time.
Right. It may be hard to remember what it was like back in the mid-80s, but there was so much that was unknown about AIDS, terrifying, and there was so much misunderstanding and fear. And, you know, Dionne found it within herself to take on a leadership role in the music industry to begin to talk about this. She did it because she recognized that the industry was being decimated. People were dying. It wasn't even clear why.
Yeah.
You know, there was tremendous misunderstanding. And, you know, she decided that she was going to do something about it. And the song, That's What Friends Are For, was something that she was going to record. She wanted to, you know, she's somebody that always sort of brings people into her process. She's, you know, somebody who really knows how to sort of gather talent around important ideas. And so she was the one who went to Elton John, who's now associated so much with the AIDS cause and has taken it on, and also to Stevie Wonder and Gladys Knight. She asked them to sing this song with her, and I believe Elizabeth Taylor was aware of this song, knew that this recording session was going to take place, and sort of suggested that this was an anthem that could, you know, sort of cut through and be important, might be utilized as a way to raise awareness about AIDS. Dion immediately said yes and made a decision to turn over all the proceeds to that recording and then, you know, performed many, many, many concerts. You know, it wasn't just a one-time thing around this. At the time, you didn't talk about AIDS. The word was not used by President Reagan. And within the black community, it was certainly not a thing that was going to be embraced, not at that time. And so, you know, to me, it just goes right to the heart of who she is. And you know, it's very telling because she went on to become a major African-American woman philanthropist and a UN ambassador. You know, that also is not a thing that, you know, many people in her station, even with her fame, were doing at that time. And so I think that's something that people don't know.
Ellen Gusevich,
I could go on.
You could, and you will next.
I could.
We will next week, next Wednesday night. In fact, the Utah Film Center, as I mentioned, they're hosting an evening with Dionne Warwick at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Ellen Gusenberg Kent will be there. Dionne will be there on stage for a conversation. Dionne will sing a few songs from her greatest hits. We have details, as I said, about that on our website, radiowest.org. Ellen Gusenberg Kent joined us from the studios of NPR in New York City. Ellen, thanks very much for the time. See you next week.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And Dave Woolley, longtime collaborator, friend of Dionne, co-authored her autobiography called My Life as I See It. He joined us from a studio on the campus of the University of Delaware in Newark, Delaware. Dave Woolley, thanks very much to you.
Thank you. And I'll be in Utah also with
you. Oh, you will. Good.
So I'm excited. Yes.
See you next week. Terrific.
We're hoping to see that place packed. We want everybody to come out and support.
Good. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
And I never thought I'd feel this way.